Hello again. I'm Stephen Saunders, an associate lecturer at the University of Central Florida. I'm a licensed psychologist and have been in practice since 1998. These podcasts are from a series of lectures I give in my teaching capacity at UCF. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved. If you'd like to contact me, you may do so at wstephensaunders@ucf.edu or call me at 352-406-0506. Enjoy the podcast. And a lot of people meditate to gain a sense of enlightenment. Do you know what enlightenment means or what enlightenment is? Yes.
Considered a higher form of knowledge of reason. There's a reason why the period where, you know, the values of what our country holds came up with it was during the time called the Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, when you transcend to a higher form of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, in its most direct way, you know, the Buddhists call it enlightenment just being awake. You're just awake, just woken up. And not only have you woken up to your own level of consciousness, but you've woken up to the great truth of life. And in Buddhism, one of the great truths of life is that life is suffering. And if you live long enough on the planet, you realize that there's a lot of wisdom in that, But there is a path out of suffering, which is the Eightfold Path that Buddhists follow. And part of that is through meditation and bringing your conscious awareness to this moment in time. That's a hard concept sometimes for my clients to figure out. And so what I do is I say, when I mean bring your consciousness and bring your attention to this moment in time, I mean right now. Right now, you're listening to my voice. You can hear the projector humming. Sometimes we hear people outside. You know, you hear someone cracking their knuckles. This is this moment in time. This is where we are. This is the present. This moment in time is all you actually can ever control in your life. Can't control the future, it hasn't happened yet. If you live in the future, it's a terribly anxious, anxiety-filled place to live. If you live in the past, you can't change that. It's already happened, it's over with. The past is a terribly depressing place to live because it's full of regrets and a lot of other things. The only place where happiness is found is in the here and now. And if you've ever listened to any lectures from the Dalai Lama, you certainly know that that is absolutely the case. But there's a lot of research that has gone into people who meditate, including Buddhist meditation, people who do, there's a Christian practice called centering prayer, which is very similar to Buddhist meditation. There's all kinds of secular ways to meditate as well. And the most popular current thing you hear about is mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is just bringing your attention to the present moment. But science has shown there's a lot of physiological changes measured in the body and brain. It's attributed to improved mental and physical health. And the benefits are not unique to meditation. One of the interesting studies I read just recently was with a group of junior high students. And they did a controlled experiment where half of a grade was trained in mindfulness meditation. The other half were simply the control group and just told to be in a room and be quiet. And then they followed to see if there was any changes in their testing outcomes for their standardized testing. The children who had studied mindfulness meditation for a semester had a 20% higher score on their standardized test than the ones who didn't. And mindfulness meditation has been shown to be as effective a technique for ADD than even the medicine is. So there's a lot of a lot of great benefits to meditation. All right, so psychoactive drugs. How do drugs affect the brain? As we talked about earlier, really just about anything that you put in your body is going to affect you, infect your brain on some level. So drugs that change consciousness and other psychological processes are known as the psychoactive drugs. And the government has a big, long list of what those are. Most alter the interactions between neurotransmitters and the receptors, and most cross the blood-brain barrier. That's why they are psychoactive. They act on the brain directly in some manner. And of course, the effects depends on their neurochemical makeup, what part of the brain, what receptor site they affect, on and on. So you have agonists and antagonists. So you have a neurotransmitter, and then you have a drug that looks very similar to the neurotransmitter. An agonist is a drug that mimics a neurotransmitter. So it does the very same thing that the neurotransmitter does it in drug form. An antagonist prevents the neurotransmitter from firing a neuron or doing its job. So you have the antagonists. So the varying effects of drugs, you know, you may have drug abuse, substance abuse. My drug of choice is alcohol. I love alcohol in all its various forms. I love wine. Wine is a very relaxed, kind of fun experience. My wife loves to drink alcohol, and wine is her big drug of choice, and bourbon. She loves Manhattans, and usually she likes Manhattans up. I've grown to like Manhattans on ice, and I also like Old Fashions, which is a bourbon drink. But I actually almost haven't found an alcohol that I don't like. But unfortunately, I have some Native American genes on my mother's side, which makes me quite susceptible to alcoholism and to alcohol, a low threshold, a low tolerance for alcohol. So my wife always shakes her head at my tolerance. I can drink one beer and get a really pretty good buzz. She's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're such a lightweight, she says. She's 100% all Northern European genes and can drink me under the table. There is a psychological dependence on drugs as well. You know, alcohol, often people with anxiety disorder will drink alcohol. Sometimes people who have a social anxiety disorder love to drink alcohol because it helps them to fit into parties a little bit better. Brings their anxiety level down. They feel like they can relate better. The problem, though, with using alcohol as an anxiety treatment is that what you're actually doing is you're messing with the arousal level of your brain. Anxiety is an over-aroused brain. And what alcohol does is it's a depressant, as you may know, and it brings your arousal level down. When your arousal level in your brain gets artificially depressed, your brain then says, hey, something is depressing our arousal level. We have got to change that. And so your brain then sends the pituitary gland and your endocrine system into action. You begin to secrete hormones and neurotransmitters and all these other things that will bring your arousal level up. So as your liver is metabolizing the alcohol and it's leaving your system, you suddenly have this flood of arousing neurotransmitters. And now, after the alcohol is worn off, not only is your arousal level back up, it's actually a little bit higher than it was before because your brain is trying to overcompensate for the dampening effects of this artificial chemical. Then guess what happens? How much alcohol does it take to have the same effect next time? More. One beer doesn't do it anymore. Now I need two. or three or four or five. I'm always amazed. I have people who come in and I'll say, do you drink alcohol? Oh, you know, just a little bit. Not much. Well, how much do you drink per day? Oh, I may go home and have a six pack or two. A six pack of beer? Yeah, or I'll drink a fifth of gin or something. Wow. It's a little drinking, right? It's always a perspective, too. What most alcoholics try to do is they try to find someone who's even a worse alcoholic to them than they are. So by comparison, their alcoholism, you know, will seem quite tame by comparison. Physical dependence, you actually can have the physical dependence on some drugs. Partly the reason that is because drugs like opiates, for example, take the place of naturally occurring endorphins. And your brain actually begins to depend upon these because it has made so many receptor sites for this flood of new endorphin-like substances that have come in. And opiates are probably one of the most addictive drugs there is. That's why we have a huge opiate epidemic in our country currently, mostly because of prescription. Opiates, unfortunately. And I've known people who were so both physically and psychologically addicted to opiates that they would actually voluntarily go into rehab, get off all of their heroin or whatever opiate they were on, and they would tell me this, I'm doing this so I can lower the threshold of how much it takes to get me high. Because if I stay clean for about 6 months, then I could kind of be back at the point where it will take a very low level again to get me the same high, because now I'm at such a large level again. There's all kind of epigenetic factors that affect relapse, and that includes both environmental as well as genetic factors. There are some people who are just predispositioned to being addicts of some sort. And then there are people who are not. And then there's also learned expectations about whether or not you can. You know, if you grew up in a culture like my wife's family where everyone drinks, you know, I'll walk into her father's house, hey, Steve, let me get you a drink. And it's not, are you going to drink? It's what are you going to drink is the question. You know, and if that's the expectation, then it's like, oh, okay, this is just normal. This is how I grew up. You know, this is kind of the norm, seeing everyone behave in this sort of way. And maybe it's you learn moderation, and maybe you don't. So CNS, central nervous system depressant drugs, come in many forms. They reduce or depress central nervous system activity. That's the brain and your spinal cord, but mainly the brain. That includes drugs like alcohol, barbiturates, and GHB. Stimulants are amphetamines. If you look at the active ingredient in the molecule of Adderall, guess what molecule looks exactly like Adderall? Crystal methamphetamine. It looks almost identical to Adderall. In fact, some suggest that Adderall really is just meth in a more tolerable form. Cocaine. Freud was a big believer in cocaine and used cocaine with himself and with his patients quite often. Cocaine is an analgesic as well as being a stimulant. Caffeine is another drug of choice of mine. I love caffeine. I typically imbibe caffeine in coffee form. You know, Starbucks is not a multi-billion-dollar business just because the drinks are yummy, right? You get addicted to it. And I've known people who are addicted to caffeine, and if they don't have their morning coffee fix or their afternoon coffee fix, they start getting very irritable and upset and mean-spirited. And you're like, oh, just, you don't want to talk to them, right, until they have their coffee. And we have jokes about it even. They sell coffee cups that says, don't talk to me until I've had my coffee. Right? Could you imagine someone having a coffee cup that said, don't talk to me until I've had my heroin, right? Or don't talk to me until I've snorted my cocaine, right? It's the same thing, really. It's still another drug. Nicotine, a lot of people are getting nicotine addicted nowadays through vaping. You know, none of you vape, do you? Please say no. It's just so annoying. Almost more annoying than smoking. It's sad, though, because I absolutely love smoking. Love to smoke. I mean, it is just such a wonderful, thrilling experience. Just the whole experience, like holding the cigarette or the cigar and lighting it and puffing on it and blowing the smoke and smelling it. And I mean, like, some of the best social experiences I've ever had in my whole life is being buzzed and smoking. You know, and I'm like, oh, I just love this. And I went to a wedding one time, and I always look around for the people who are kind of getting a little antsy, and they leave the reception. And I always follow them because I know they're going to go find a place to smoke. And so I was at a wedding one time back in my single days, and there was this very attractive young woman who left, and she was one of the bridesmaids. And so I followed her. I figured she was going to go smoking, and sure enough, she's out smoking, and I bummed a cigarette off her, and we became very dear friends for the next several days and weeks. That was fun experience. MDMA, actually, they are now using MDMA for its original purpose. Back in the 50s and 60s, MDMA was actually created as an enhancement for psychotherapy. They would give people ecstasy before they started their therapy session, and it helped with openness and all these different things. They've done recent studies with MDMA and post-traumatic stress disorder, and it has been shown to be a very effective adjunct to psychotherapy, and they're even saying, because it's had an 85% effectiveness rate, they're saying it could be a first-line treatment for PTSD. And it's actually on the fast track. The FDA has put it on the fast track to be approved as a new psychoactive drug that psychiatrists would prescribe in conjunction with psychotherapy for people who have had post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's about to hit the market as something legit. But mainly used today as a street drug, party drug. A lot of people who go to the Electric Daisy Carnival love to find ecstasy and MDMA, and then it makes the experience so much more enhancing. The problem with it, though, is that if you overdose on it, or even if you just even take a moderate dose of MDMA, what it actually is doing in the ecstasy effect is it's telling your brain and in your nervous system, hey, release all your serotonin now. And your brain says, some of your serotonin? No, all of it. And it says, okay. And so all the serotonin stored in your neurons, in your fat cells, in your body gets released all at once. I'm walking on a cloud, I'm floating, and oh, I want to be touched, oh, I want to hug you, give me a hug, right? You've seen people on ecstasy who behave in that kind of manner. But the next day, incredibly, incredibly depressed. You know, when it wears off, because your brain has totally depleted its serotonin level, and then a lot of people will start chasing that high, and they'll take it again the next day, and they don't feel anything, or they even have a very negative reaction to it, because you've depleted all your serotonin. You got to give your body time to repair that and get back to it. There have been studies with people who have chronically abused ecstasy to the point where they have to be on permanent antidepressants just to regulate their serotonin level, or they can't even function. So it can be a dangerous drug. Opiates can induce sleep and relieve pain. They're a very highly addictive class of drugs, like we said. Opium is one, morphine, heroin, codeine. I'm terribly allergic to all the opiates. Codeine makes me break out in rashes and I have a an allergic and asthmatic reaction to it. I almost can't even be given any opiate, even for serious surgeries and such. The only one that I can tolerate is a synthetic version, but even that, not for very long. Hallucinogenic drugs have been studied at length recently. Ketamine is one that is now actually being used in Florida off-label with psychiatrists to treat depression. And what they have found is that a lot of these drugs, like LSD, ketamine, and the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, which is psilocybin, has been shown to be incredibly effective for depression. One of the old theory about why the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac worked was that the old theory was that it regulated your brain chemistry and it improves the amount of serotonin that was available to your brain, and that made you happier. What they have now found through a lot of imaging studies and brain tissue studies is that what they actually think that the antidepressants are doing is that they are inducing increased dendritic growth and increased brain density in the number of neurons that occur, and that this is actually what is happening and giving you the positive mood affect feeling. Because what they have found is that people who are chronically depressed have fewer dendritic connections in their brain than otherwise. Guess what ketamine and psilocybin do very effectively and very quickly? Ketamine and psilocybin tell your nerves to go into overdrive growing dendrites. In a single two-hour session, ketamine will dramatically increase both your brain density and the number of dendrites that are growing in your brain. And it relieves depression, not in 6 weeks that it usually takes most antidepressants, including Prozac, but in 30 minutes to 2 hours, people have a complete remission of their depression. That's incredible. There was a Johns Hopkins study done with psilocybin where they gave a group of 20 people psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, like I said. And magic mushrooms, if you've ever taken those, you know that high and low lasts you for like 6 hours or so, or I've heard. And people begin to feel like really, really, really good. And most tribal societies who use hallucinogens know the power of these substances. And so you have to go through a long initiation in most tribal societies before you're even allowed to use the peyote or the ayahuasca or the psilocybin or any of those, so that you're psychologically prepared for your experience. What do most Westerners do? Oh, Wayne gave me some mushrooms, man. You want to do it? Yeah. Am I ready for my trip? No. I am not psychologically ready, you know? And so like, you have a terrible experience on it. Most of the time with hallucinogens, including marijuana, whatever emotional state you start off on is the emotional state you're going to end up on in your experience. So it behooves you to get into the right psychological mindset. I know I had a old college buddy friend who was he was all about like sitting with you while you went through your drug experience. You know, he wore these robes. He was all about being kind of the shaman of the dorm. You know, like, man, you don't want to be alone when you go through this. So he would sit with you while you were going through your thing. And I'm not sure if he ever took anything at the same time. It seemed like he was always high, so who knows. So here's a nice handy-dandy major class of psychoactive drugs. Kind of go down the line. I know people who have tried almost all of these. Depends on what you're looking for. All right, any questions about consciousness or any of that stuff? Before we move on to learning. All right. All right, so what is learning? So when you learn something, what is it? According to your book, it's a relatively permanent change of behavior or knowledge due to experience. So you experience something and you learn. You know, if you're a very young child and you ever reach up and you touch a hot stove, that's all it takes to learn not to do that ever, ever again. You learn because through that experience. Same thing with playing a piano or learning the ukulele. That's my favorite musical instrument of choice. I love the ukulele because you can't be sad and play the ukulele at the same time. That's certainly my therapy of choice. I'll bring my ukulele sometime and play you guys a song. I love to subject my students to my ukulele playing because it's the only forced audience I have. I know you guys can't go anywhere and you have to clap respectfully no matter how horrible it is. All right, so classical conditioning is one set of learning. You probably experienced classical conditioning in your own life. If you've ever gotten into your car and you turn on the radio and that particular song starts playing, and suddenly you have this flood of memories and emotions, and you remember when you were with him, and oh, he was so beautiful, and oh, why did we break up? Oh, this was our song, oh my gosh. And then, you know, you start drinking and you're listening to the song over and over again, then you make the terrible mistake of texting your ex, right? Oh, never do that. I did that one time and I got back, who is this? Very sad. But classical conditioning was first discovered by Ivan Pavlov, and you may have heard about this. Pavlovian conditioning is when a neutral stimulus is repeatedly paired with a stimulus that triggers an automatic reflective response. For my dog, I have this ceramic treat bowl, and when that lid comes off the treat bowl, it makes a very specific tink, 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 ceramic, you know, kind of sound that it makes. Well, it don't matter where he is in the house. He hears that tink, tink, tink sound. He knows that means a treat is about to appear, and he will come running. And he's sitting there, oh, boy, a treat. And if you make that sound with any other kind of ceramic bowl or whatever, and you don't have a treat there, he gets very upset. And he starts whining and going around in circles. That's a form of classical conditioning. So the unconditioning stimulus is the treat that I'm about to give my dog. The unconditioned response is their salivation and their emotional response or happiness at getting this treat. That's unconditioned. We're genetically, biologically wired to want food, right? And so are dogs and most animals. The conditioned stimulus is the tink, tink, tink sound of the ceramic bowl. The conditioned response is identical to the unconditioned response. Salivation, getting happy, all of that, because they learn that one thing means the others. Pavlov learned something almost identical to that. He was actually studying, he was not a psychologist, he was a physiologist, and he was studying the salivation rate of dogs. But he noticed that when he began to open the door and approach his dogs at a certain time of day, they would begin salivating just at the sound of his footsteps. That was the conditioned response. The footsteps were the conditioned response to getting the treat that he was about to give them. And that's pretty much what we just talked about. You see classical conditioning happen all the time. You know, our experience with brands of any kind. The thing that was so horrifying I learned when I had children was that my children, before, when they were pre-verbal, they weren't even talking yet, recognized certain brands and were classically conditioned to flipping out and wanting that particular thing that they knew that brand represented. The McDonald's arches was one thing. My oldest son, I couldn't drive by McDonald's without him flipping out. Wanted McDonald's so bad, right? I didn't help with that because I also wanted McDonald's and would pull in and get fries and a milkshake or whatever we'd share. And he was, oh, so fantastic. You know, that's classical conditioning. Advertisers really want to create a strong conditioned response with you in connection to their brand. You know, and each brand that you think about in your own life and the brands you particularly love evoke a certain emotional response in you. You know, you think about the Disney brand. You know, what does the Disney brand evoke in people? Why do people spend thousands of dollars to go and experience the Disney brand experience?
Childhood whimsy.
Connected to our childhood, right? My grandparents gave me a bunch of these records, and I remember the introduction to this day. I would put the vinyl record on, and I would hear the introduction to these books. This is a Disneyland, and it's a long playing record, and I am your story reader. We'll begin now to read the story of Br'er Rabbit. You can read along with me in your book. You'll know it is time to turn the page when Tinkerbell rings her little bells like this. Bring. Let's begin now. One day, Br'er Rabbit was walking in the woods. And he would tell you the whole story. And like, oh. And every time, you know, I think of the Disney brand, I think of my grandmother and her pound cake and, you know, how wonderful it was to be at my grandparents' house and listening to these stories. And, you know, that's a classically conditioned response that Disney is delighted that they have put in me, right? It's a kind of learning. However, conditioned responses over time can be extinguished. You see this happen all the time with dog learning behavior. You know, you'll spend weeks and weeks and weeks training your dog to do the certain trick. I had a dog who passed away, unfortunately, but I had him for years and years. He was a really sweet dog, and he was a former drug dog. And he had spent about 2 years in this drug dog training, but he was so sweet and loved people so much that he had rather play with the, you know, assailant or the criminal that the police were trying to capture rather than, you know, doing his job. So they adopted him out to us. But all that behavior that he had learned was still there, and he knew all of these hand signals. So I could give him these hand signals, and he would go down. I could go like this, and he would run into a room, and he would circle the room looking for someone, and he would come back out. And he was a big, huge, black German Shepherd. So it was very intimidating, even though he was a big softy and wouldn't hurt a fly. But he looked like he would just, you know, eat you alive. So it was fun from that perspective. Yeah.
Would this type of conditioning be also part, because there's this phenomenon that on Twitter that I think is put forward that's very funny. It's called the I can hear images thing, where if you put an image in front of something on something that goes to a video, then you'll actually, upon seeing the image, even though it's not the video, by looking at the image, you'll remember what you heard when the video was playing. So like,
oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you can smell images too. I mean, sometimes images will evoke a certain smell or something along those lines, because it's just the memory of what's been in classically conditioned and you've learned. So extinction is the loss of a conditioned response over time. So the dogs, what Pavlov found, would actually lose the ringing the bell. Pavlov would pair ringing the bell after he figured it out with that, but they lost it over time, but it can be relearned. And then spontaneous recovery means that the reappearance of a conditioned response after it stopped showing it. Here's kind of how it looks on graphical form. Interstimulus generalization, you kind of generalize that. Most phobias, things that people are fearful of, is nothing more than a form of classical conditioning. You know, I'm afraid of cats, someone might say. when I was a child, a cat jumped on me and scratched me and scared the living days out of me. And now I can't stand cats. I hate cats. And I'm afraid of cats. You know, that's a fear. They have a phobia of cats. And it's a classically conditioned response. You can classically condition your loved ones unbeknownst to them by ignoring behavior you don't want and paying attention to and rewarding behavior you do want. So that's a form of both classical and operant conditioning. So the signaling of significant effects are conditioned responses simply robot-like. They certainly provide a means for developing expectations and mental representations. And they're important for adaptation and survival. So what determines whether conditions response are learned? They develop, responses develop when one event signals the appearance, you know, of another event. Our whole traffic system is based on classical conditioning. You see a red light, your foot automatically does something. See a green light, automatically does something. Yellow light does something. Factors influencing learning of conditioned responses is timing, predictability, and the intensity of it, the attention you're paying to it, the bio-preparedness you have. If you've ever been into a casino, you will notice that there are no windows in casinos and no clocks in casinos. Why is that, do you think?
The whole goal of the casino is to keep you in for as long as possible. And so when you don't know how much time has passed, and you might be thinking, oh, I'm just going to spend an hour here. But then all of a sudden time in your perception will end up speeding up.
Yeah, they want to keep you up, they want to keep you there, they want to keep you happy, they want to keep you focused on gambling all of your money away, and then when you're out of your money, they hope you leave and come back with more money. And they make it very easy for you, they have ATM machines everywhere for you to get all your stuff. So bio-preparedness is a form of conditioned taste aversions. Certain tastes, certain things we learn is not good for us, and so we try to avoid it, or we have a bad experience with a certain thing and don't care for it, like the circus peanuts. Overcoming fears, a role in developing of phobias. As I said, phobias are really just classically conditioned responses. One way to get rid of phobias is through a therapeutic technique called systematic desensitization. I had a client who was a very successful businessman, born and raised in Florida, and loved road trips, but hated flying. In fact, he was very fearful of flying. He had gotten involved in a company and had promoted up to a certain executive level that now he had gotten a promotion to district manager for the whole Southeast, and his company wanted to start flying him to all the different offices. So he'd have to fly to Atlanta and to Charlotte and to Houston and New Orleans and Jackson, Mississippi and Nashville and all around the Southeast. And he came to me, he's like, I really want this promotion because it's really gonna help my family and I'm gonna make more money and it's really a good step in my career, but I don't think I can fly and there's no way I can reach there by train or automobile in time to all these meetings. You've got to help me. So we began the process of systematically desensitizing his fear of airplanes. And the way you do that is that you first get the client to create what's known as a hierarchy of fears. So what's the absolute worst case scenario? Well, the worst case scenario is I'm 25,000 feet up in the air, I'm in the plane, and I can't get out, it starts having turbulence, and it's going all over the place, and then the pilot says, oh my God, the engines are out, we're diving, we're going in, we're all gonna die, and like that's my worst case scenario. All right, so what is a one level fear? Well, the one level fear is just thinking about having to go on an airplane, and just thinking about having to buy a ticket and being on an airplane. Okay. So we create this hierarchy of fears, and then you begin to teach the person, sometimes through hypnosis, sometimes through meditation, you teach them how to relax and to stay in a relaxed, bodily relaxed position, but an alert mind. So relaxed body, alert mind. Then you get them to expose themselves to first level of fear. All right, so thinking about buying a ticket, tell me where your anxiety is, 1 to 10. Is it manageable? And so you move on up. So we moved on over a 6-week period of time. We moved up to our final session, was we actually got into my car and we drove to the airport. We had lunch at the airport and we sat at the window and watched the planes take off and pull down. And he meditated, took deep breaths, and stayed in that relaxed position. Now, he still had anxiety when he went flying, but it was manageable. And he didn't have to find another job and was successfully able to do that. That's how phobias are gotten rid of. Drug addiction is a habituation and opponent process theory. Basically, you know, people get classically conditioned to certain drugs because they have these wonderful feelings with them and they have a sense of tolerance. You know about the drug cycle, I'm sure. Instrument and operant conditioning. Operant conditioning is nothing more than learning by the consequences of the behavior. And that's what we have found is that most mammals, including humans, learn best through operant conditioning when there is a positive reinforcer. Both positive and negative reinforcers, all reinforcers, always increase the likelihood of a behavior. Increase the likelihood of it. Punishments always decrease the likelihood of the behaviors. So that's how you always know the difference. Positive and negative in terms of operant conditioning, all that means is something given to you or is something taken away? So I want you to pay attention and clean your room. I'm going to apply negative reinforcement because I want to increase room cleaning behavior. I'm going to take away your telephone that you're obsessed and addicted to. And you're not going to get your telephone back until you clean your room. I'm trying to increase the behavior. That's negative reinforcement. Then I tell you, when you finish cleaning your room, I'm going to give you your phone back. That's positive reinforcement. I'm giving someone something to increase the behavior. So using negative and positive reinforcement. Learning is governed by the law of effect. And it's a kind of instrumental sort of conditioning. Here's Thorndike's puzzle box. He was able to successfully teach birds and other animals how to initiate this puzzle box and get into it to get a treat through operant conditioning. When I used to go to the county fair, there was a chicken that could play the piano. Have you ever seen the piano playing chicken? Yep. And birds are one of the animals that are really easy to shape their behavior by operant conditioning. So every single time the chicken would get close to the piano, they would get fed. And then when they touched the piano, they would get fed. When they pecked the piano, they would get fed. When they pecked a key, they would get fed. And you kept shaping the behavior until they were only rewarded when they pecked certain keys in certain sequence. And it takes a lot of patience and a lot of time to train a bird to do that, but you can train a bird to do that sort of thing. Crows are one of the most intelligent birds. In fact, pound for pound, in relation to their body size, birds have a brain in relation to their body size almost as large as humans. They're incredibly intelligent animals. And there's this one scientist who developed a study and actually looked at how crows not only learned new behaviors, but would teach other crows the behaviors. So he got two crows that he taught that if they found coins on the ground, in the lab, anywhere on the ground, and put them into this machine, they would get a peanut that would come out. The crows became obsessed with finding coins and putting them in the machines. Now, they shaped the crows' behavior so that it wasn't any shiny object, or it wasn't any object they got rewarded for. They only got rewarded if they put coins into the machine. The man put this machine in a park and released these two trained crows into the wild. A month later, he had almost $1,000 in coins that this murder of crows, this team of crows, had scoured the city looking for coins. Have you heard this study? Yeah. Yeah, it's a really fascinating study and how he was able to shape the crow's behavior. What?
That's like the ultimate get rich quick
scheme. Yeah. You know, it's just operant conditioning. There's our old pal, B.F. Skinner. B.F. Skinner was a very strict behaviorist, and he did a lot of laboratory animal training sorts of things. He very much believed in a purely positive reinforcement kind of training method with animals, and it really helped to pioneer a lot of the not only animal behavioral training we have today, but also behavioral training that we have with people who are developmentally delayed, severely autistic, or other people who can't communicate or reason or logic in normal ways that an average person would be able to. They can still learn new behaviors through operant conditioning. So operant is the operant response. Positive and negative reinforcers, I kind of explained that a little bit. Escape and avoidance conditioning. You know, you see this all the time. We talked about this a little bit last week, I think, when we talked about avoiding punishment. And anyone use the Waze app when they drive? You know, or do you use a radar detector? You know, sometimes punishment is just a way to avoid a punishment or something. We try to figure out how to get around it. Discriminative conditioned stimulus is simply control. So stimulus discrimination basically means that you only are responding to a very specific kind of stimulus. You know, when you hear this buzzer and only this buzzer at this certain tone and certain frequency, then you will get rewarded. All other buzzers or sounds or tones you do not get rewarded for, and you can train someone to have stimulus discrimination. Or the opposite, any old buzzer, any old sound that even approximates this sound will give you a reward. That's stimulus generalization. So positive reinforcement example is a behavior. You put coins into a vending machine, the presentation of a pleasant or positive stimulus, you get to receive a bag of chips or a Coke or a candy or whatever you're looking for. And so the frequency of behavior increases. You put coins in the vending machine in the future because you know or hope that you're going to get your reward. Now, have you ever seen someone who put coins in the vending machine and it got stuck or they didn't get what they were supposed to get? You ever seen that behavior? They flip out. They shake the vending machine, they start beating it, you know, they get very upset. They're not getting their positive reinforcement. Negative reinforcement is the behavior in the middle of a, you're in the middle of a boring date. So you say you have a headache. The termination of the unpleasant stimulus, the terrible date, you get to leave them. And so the frequency of the behavior increases. You use the same tactic on future boring dates. I have a headache, I gotta get out of here. You know, that's negative reinforcement. So here's the shuttle box's escape conditioning. It's kind of a no-brainer. The dog gets shocked, and then they play a loud horn sound or a bell sound, and the dog learns to associate the bell or the horn sound with the shock, and so you don't even have to shock them anymore. You just play the sound, and they know to avoid that area. That's how, if you've ever seen the shock collar that you give, put dogs on and they have the electronic fence, that's what the process works on. The dog first learns that if they cross the boundary of the yard, they'll get a static electricity shock that's unpleasant. They don't want to avoid that. And the collar also plays a very high-pitched sound, a little beep that's barely audible and mostly audible to the dog. And so then the dog associates the high pitch sound with the shock. And then after the dog learns, you can turn the shock off and just have the collar play the beep sound, and the dog stays in the yard without any fence. stimulus discrimination in teaching this pigeon that only certain patterns will give them a reward, and so they learn to peck or choose that certain pattern. Shaping is like we said, you know, you shape a behavior. The closer they get to that particular behavior, the easier it is. I have parents all the time who bring their kids in often thinking they have a psychological problem, but they really don't. They've just given, they're not positively enforcing their child's behavior. They're not shaping it correctly. And often they're giving a child an abstract command or direction when the child cognitively is in the concrete stage of development and has no idea what you're talking about. A good example is, go clean your room. Now, all of you are adults and you probably know what that means, but to a young child who's in the pre-operational stage of cognitive development or the concrete stage of cognitive development, what are you talking about, right? So you have to break that down into basic discrete tasks. Pick your toys up off the floor and put them into this box. That is very concrete and not as abstract as clean your room. You know, take all of your clothes that are on the floor, put it in the hamper. And then you give treats. I've had kids that I've helped train that are so ADD that I had to have a bowl of M&Ms, and every single behavior that approximated or approached the homework doing kind of behavior I'm trying to reinforce, I would give them an M&M. And I do that sometimes with testing with kids who are really ADD and they can't focus very long for testing. And I'll say, get through this part of the test and you get a treat. And suddenly they're all about focusing, you know, and then you give them a treat. Of course, you always want to make sure that the treat or the positive reinforcer you're trying to give someone is something they actually want. If it's not anything they actually want, then it's not going to be a reinforcer. So if you're giving them M&Ms, but they really want Skittles, then what are you reinforcing? You may not be reinforcing them anything. The timing of reinforcement definitely helps. There's different timing schedules or reinforcement schedules that have been shown to be more addictive than not. The intermittent reinforcement schedule that occurs with slot machines, you don't get paid every single time you pull that lever. You only get paid when you pull it a certain number of times, and you do not know how many times you've got to pull this lever in order to get paid. So you pull it and you pull it and you pull it. I have a buddy who's a slot machine fanatic, and he's got a theory that for winning. And he goes into a casino and he finds the dirtiest, filthiest, most disgusting slot machine he can find. One that, you know, people have just used and used it all day. Because his theory is it's about to pay out. It's been really used a lot. He won $3,000 one time in a slot machine after two pulls on his disgusting slot machine theory. So I'm like, there's something to that. I got reinforced vicariously from listening to his theory. You say that's baloney.
I'm a stats major. I know.
Yeah, right. So continuous reinforcement, that's like you get a job, you get a paycheck every week. You're getting reinforced to go do the job. Partial intermittent reinforcement, that's like the slot machine. And here are the different areas of the reinforcers. Fixed ratio, fixed interval. That's the paycheck, on and on. Fixed ratio is like being paid by the behavior. You know, make this many widgets. After every five widgets you make, you get paid. That's the fixed ratio. Variable ratio, you're not quite sure when you're going to get paid, but you know you eventually will for the necessary responses. This is how I got paid with my allowance. My allowance was not every week. It was just based on my parents' arbitrary evaluation of how good I did in my chores that week. And you never knew whether you were going to be in a good mood or a bad mood. Like, well, you hope they would be in a good mood. And here it is graphed out. On and on. All right, I think we're about out of time. Anybody have any questions? I'll stick around for a few minutes and answer questions, but Have a great evening, everybody. I'll see y'all next week. Yeah, your test is online tomorrow. So make sure you take it. But it'll be open, you know, through the weekend. So I think it is open through the weekend, yeah. I don't think it closes. I think it. I think it's due. That it, if you don't do it by then, it'll say it's late. I kind of give you a mulligan, 2 or 3 days, plus or minus. I'm not going to really count off. But you know, if you're 2 weeks late on it, that obviously that's you got a problem. So.
So I just got a question. So what are you actually using the recording for?
I'm going to turn them into podcasts.